Like I promised, I'm going to tell you a little joke before we start. Since I wrote down a 45-minute stand-up for this evening, and I'm just going to tell one little joke. Well, since there are the three of you here, this story is about three people. There were these three alcoholics, and sitting in a bar in England. One alcoholic from England, one from Ireland, and one from Scotland. Sitting together and drinking Guinnesses. For some reason or another, I don't know, just follows the story, that three flies are in the air, you know, flying together, having fun. And they all hit the beers at the same time. And the Englishman looks at his Guinness, you know, squeamish alcoholic like me, you know. I have to have my beer ice cold, well, at least the first one. Then it doesn't really matter after that. But this must have been his first, because he looks at his Guinness and goes, "Oh, daft. Bugger me. Bartender, would you take that away, please, and give me another beer? That's revolting. Couldn't drink that in a million years. Thank you." And he gets another beer. All right. The Irish guy, poor, religious, and drunk, looks at the beer and goes, "Oh, look at that. No, it doesn't really matter, does it? We bring all God's children, aren't we? Look at that, sir. Look at that little flame there, eh? How you doing, little boy? Let's drink this together. Cheerio." And drinks up, no problem. The guy from Scotland is pissed. "Oh, no, for fuck's sake, this is not happening! Shite! Come on, you fucker! Come on, you fucker! Shite! What are you doing there? Fuck are you! Come on! Or I'm going to get you, you fucker! Shite! For fuck's sake! All right, here we go, you fucker! Come on! Spit it out right now! Hey, you! Spit it out, hey!" You can't curse in AA, right? You told me that today. Well, he's here. He's back. All you people came here to see him. And without further ado, I've been looking forward for this for a long time. The one and only Earl Hightower.
My name is Earl, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
everyone. First, I want to once again thank those that have taken such good care of us on this trip. I want to thank Siggy for everything that he has done for us. He's been a very gracious man. Thor, Sola, feed us, dance with us, sing to us. It's brilliant. And all the others, Ellie, wherever, I don't know where he is. He's around somewhere, I imagine. And just all the people that I've met, you've all been so kind to us. And it's just really been a magical trip. It's been magical. The MC, the master, the best. We want to bring him to America. You know, tour 2003. Just start all the meetings. Just start a meeting and go. And then just kick off a meeting and go. Like, yeah, I don't even know what he's talking about, and I love it. It's just great energy. And also, I wanted my two cents on those of you in the kitchen staff, the chef, everybody that helped. I've been to almost 400 conferences in my sobriety and speaking around the world. And I can say without question, that is the finest meal I have ever had at a conference. So, I see that my time is up. So, I am an alcoholic. I drank. Yes, I drank. I did not start drinking until I was 12. I held off as long as I possibly could. I had been restless, irritable, and discontented for some time prior to that. And I didn't have a plan, you know? I didn't know that alcohol was the answer for me. I didn't know it was the thing that would kill the fear. I didn't know that it was the thing that would bring to me the ease and contentment that I sought. I didn't know that it would make all things even and right in the world for me. I didn't know that. I was 12 years old. I got shipped off to boarding school when I was 12. My father came in my room and said, get in the car. So I went and got in the car. And there were several family members there, and a caravan of cars drove off. And we drove and drove and drove and drove and drove. And we got to the base of the foothill of this mountain, and there was a school campus there. And I got out of the car, and my father got out of the car, and he put a suitcase down next to me, and nobody else got out of the car. And he shook my hand, and he said, "This will make a man out of you." Got in the car, and they drove off. I was in boarding school. Now, the fact is, I was given an opportunity for a wonderful education, held me in good stead to this very day. The feeling was that I had just been thrown away by the people who knew me best in the world, and I didn't know what I had done to be cast out of the family. Given the choice, I've never been one to pay much attention to the facts. It's the feelings that I focus on and have always focused on, and it hit me in my gut. And I called home for 3 days, talking to my mother, begging her to come get me. I was 12 years old. I was 5 feet tall, 103 pounds. As my father put it, manhood was just around the corner. I was a child. And I called home begging my mother to, you know, come get me, bring me home. And I could hear my father in the background, "Hang up!" And she'd just say, "Sorry, I gotta go." Click. And after 3 days, it was like something broke inside me. And I thought, you know what? If you don't want me, I don't want you. And I turned my back on my family and pretty much never went back. And I entered into this journey of this new world. And this new world was a think tank for boys. They had done some tests on me, and they discovered that I had a very high IQ. I don't have it anymore, so I'm not bragging. It's long gone. And they'd scoured the earth to find 250 of the brightest, most disturbed young men they could possibly find, and they put us all on this campus. It was like a Lord of the Flies in this place. It was just crazy. And I was the youngest and the smallest kid in the whole school. And I was walking around campus just kind of, you know, books under my arm, trying not to make eye contact with anybody. And Tiny found me. Every high school has a guy named Tiny. He's, you know, 6'4", 240 pounds, you know. Plays guard on the football team. Actually, Tiny found me. And he walked up and he said, "How you doing, punk?" And he slapped me in the back of the head, sent me and my books flying. And I had this, like, out-of-body experience where I was watching as I walked up to Tiny. Voice in my head was saying, "Don't do this." You know, as I walked right up to Tiny and hit him as hard as I could, which had no effect on Tiny whatsoever. And I just stood there looking up at this guy. And he looked down at me and he said, "You got a lot of guts, kid." And then he beat the crap out of me on the spot. And as I'm taking the beating, I'm thinking, this is going pretty good. Because I was absolutely terrified of this guy. But he had said, "You got a lot of guts." My violence had masked the fear. He didn't know I was afraid. So it was a victory of sorts for me. And I went back to my little dorm room sitting around waiting for the bleeding to stop. And word spread across this campus like wildfire. "Watch out for this little Hightower kid. He's a maniac. He attacked Tiny." So now I got this reputation that has absolutely nothing to do with who I am. I'm a frightened child, right? Now I'm a wild man. So the cool guys started to come around. They click, right? And I'm sitting in my room, and this guy named Matt sticks his head in the doorway, and he says, "Hey, you want to smoke a joint?" And I looked at him and I said, "Yes, I do." And I didn't have any idea what he was talking about. And it really didn't matter. What I heard was, "Do you want to hook up with us?" The answer was, "Yeah, I'm alone in the universe, right? Yeah." He could have said, "Listen, we're going to go kill the Spanish teacher. Do you want to come?" But, "Yeah, I'm with you. Let's go." And so we swung by Steve's room, and Steve had a Tupperware container full of cheap red wine wrapped in tin foil. I mean, no grapes involved red wine. Cheap, fortified stuff, right? And we went behind the dorm, a 12-year-old, two 13-year-olds, children. And he fired up the joint, and he took a hit, and I just did what he did. And, ugh, that burned my lungs and my throat. Ugh. Passed that along, got knots on my head, you know, I'm dizzy. Then the wine came around, I thought, well, we'll try this. And I took a long pull on the wine, and then went down and just burned my stomach, and the vapors were coming up, you know what I mean? And I'm handing this off and thinking, this sucks. I mean, just like a few days ago, I was living with my family, I was happy, everything was nice, right? Boom, right? I got large people trying to kill me. I got knots on my head. I've been thrown away by my family. My lungs are burning. I'm standing here with these two total strangers. My stomach hurts. I hate my... The way this is going, I'm going to be dead by Friday. It's just spiraling down. And I'm miserable, miserable. I don't stare at these two guys, right? And they're teenagers, right? I'm only 12. It's like a big deal, you know what I mean? They're lording it over me. And it happened. Just that thing that makes me bodily different from my fellows occurred. And suddenly this warm feeling just kind of came up over me. And for the first time in my little 12 years, I was comfortable standing where I was standing, doing what I was doing with the people I was doing it with. Everything was okay. And I didn't know, is it the pot? Is it the wine? Is it the fact that I'm standing here with my two very close personal friends, Matt and Steve? Because I'm feeling that. These are my boys now, right? And I don't care what caused it. All I know is my experience that first night was I can feel better than I've ever felt before in my life. I can feel empowered. I can feel the fear just slide off of me. I can be comfortable talking to these guys. My family doesn't want me? Screw them. I don't want them. Tiny got a problem with me? Bring it, Tiny. Let's go again. See what happens. I'm feeling it now. And I'm okay. I'm okay. I'm okay. And nobody died that night. Nobody went to prison that night. Nobody went to the mental institution that night. No blood was drawn. All those things were going to happen. But that was not my experience at that moment. My experience was feel better than you've ever felt before in your life, and nothing bad happens. I'm in. I am in. I got to find out where Matt and Steve are hanging out tomorrow. I go back to my room, get some sleep, get up, get my little books, shake it off, back to school, no harm, no foul. So it was a humble beginning for me, a little pot, a little wine, and I'm off to the races. And I made a commitment. I need to do this as often as I possibly can, which turned into every day for the next 16 years, no matter what. Many good reasons came along the way why I should stop drinking and using. Many good reasons. I never touched the brakes because I didn't know how to. I mean, it became like my breathing so early in my life. 13 was pills. The only reason I took a pill was a guy walked up to me and said, would you like a couple of pills? And I said, well, yes, I would. I would like a couple of pills. And he gave them to me. And 20 minutes later, I'm laying on the floor and I'm very happy there. I feel very good down there. That same feeling is coming over me, drinking and the pot and the pill and everything. It's the same. I'm on the floor. And all I wanted to know was, what do you call that? Tunol. I got strung out on Tunol, Secanol, Placidil, all that stuff. And 14 was psychedelics. And the only reason I took a psychedelic is I was on a 10-hour pass from boarding school with Debbie. Yeah. Debbie. Debbie was a bad girl. And I have respect for Debbie to this day. Debbie was a bad girl and an older woman. She was 15 and a half. And Debbie, I was very enamored with Debbie. And Debbie said, would you like to drop some acid? And I said, well, yes, I would, Debbie. Once again, I have no idea what's going on. So Debbie has a lipstick tube and spins it up, and there's a little pill on the end. And I just took it and popped it in my mouth and swallowed it. And she said, did you take that whole thing? I said, well, yes, Debbie, I did. It was a very small thing. I'm using these horse caps. I've been knocking back. It was very tiny. And she said, well, that was three hits of white lightning. Uh-huh, yeah. Needless to say, the next 2 days were very interesting. Very interesting. At one point, I kind of came out of that acid blackout, and I'm in a market. And she's with me, and we're pretending we're married. And I looked at her and I said, do we have any children? And she looked at me and said, yes, two. And I said, then we're going to need these diapers right here. And I kind of faded back out, and that's all I remember about that. But to this day, markets are difficult for me. I go into markets. If you ever notice, I don't know about here, but in America, they block off all the exits. You go in through a turnstile, and the only way out is through a checker. So somebody to check you out. So you're trapped in there. And the lighting and the little rows and everything's this, you know, nice and neat and tidy. And the neon lighting, it can get a little spooky in there. And a lot of decisions have to be made in a market. You know, do I want the cream corn, the regular corn, the corn on the cob somewhere over there? Screw it, I'll come back later. Have you ever seen the cart? You're in the market, and you're just rolling down the aisle, and you see a cart just there. There's nobody with the abandoned cart. I understand that guy. That guy just went too far and just said, I'll be back later. There's too many decisions. I don't like markets this day. Anyway, humble beginnings. 15, I started shooting drugs. And the only reason that I did that was because I was on a boat in Marina Del Rey, California. And another girl, Cammy, lovely girl, walked up to me with a syringe in her hand and said, would you like me to stick this in your body? And I said, well, yes, I would, Cammy. And she did, and it was a very good shot. It was one of those ones where you just go, and on the way down, I'm thinking, if that didn't kill me, I'm doing it again, because that was great. Now, I'm talking about drugs, and I identify as an alcoholic, and I have to explain. I'm a child of the 60s. And we were the hippies, you know? We were the hippies. We were carving out our own identity. We were not going to drink ourselves to death the way our parents were doing. We were going to kill ourselves in a whole new way. We were carving out our identity. So we were very, very focused on the drugs. But the fact of the matter is, for me, and you have to understand, any knowledge or real information I have about my life is in retrospect, having done inventory work, having really thought back on it with some kind of honesty. And look, and the truth for me was, my drug of choice was, what do you got? I mean, it's all anti-oral medication to me. If I can get enough of what you've got in my body, it'll kill the fear. And that's what this is all about for me. It's the fear killer. It's the thing that makes it possible for me to breathe like other people breathe, to see the world like I think other people see it, to walk out into the world and interact with other human beings. That's what it does for me. It takes that gnawing anxiety, that fear that lived inside me all my days. It takes it away. And it's vital to my ability to function at all. I prefer going down. I like alcohol, heroin, barbiturates. These are a few of my favorite things. I like that direction. But if you don't have any of those, can't go down, let's go up. Can't go down, don't have any of that, I'll take a big bag of the cocaine, please. Because my idea of a good night's just sitting around checking my pulse. Not doing anything else, just sitting. There's another one. Yeah, it's beaten. Good. Okay, I like that. Nothing going on. But if I can't, up is fine. I'm happy to go on window patrol. I'm happy to drive the freeways, decoding license plates in a psychotic state. Sure, that's up or down is fine. Doesn't really matter, because my most important thing for me is I have to get out of right here, right now. Because right here, right now, I'm self-centered and I'm afraid. Right here, right now, I'm never measuring up. I'm comparing my insides to your outsides, and I'm losing every time. I can't find my way into the world when I'm right here, so I got to get out of now. I got to. Alcohol was the drug that was always on the table. The other drugs would come and go, but alcohol had to be there for me. It had to be. I'm so tired, I just felt like I was going to faint. Not a problem if I faint. Carl can finish the story. He knows it. That's the way we are. If I just go over, they just drag me off to the side and Carl get up and we keep going. Alcohol. Drugs would come and go. Alcohol was the only thing that was always on the table. And there's a reason for that, in my opinion. Alcohol is reliable. Drugs are completely unreliable. Completely unreliable. There's no quality control going on out there. You don't know what you're going to get in. You don't know what it is, how good it is, until you get it in your body. You go get a fifth of Jack Daniels. You go get a quart of good gin. You know what you got here. this is the reliable stuff. So no matter what else was going on, the bottle was there. You do so much cocaine, you can't get your mouth open anymore. Right? And it's 7:30 and the party just started and you've completely overshot the mark one more time. Right? Doesn't matter. Suck a little gin through your teeth, loosen your right up, and you can go on with the party. Heroin, not enough heroin to get you that cool, quiet, just heart and lungs working place? Don't worry about it. Jack Daniels will get you there. Jack, you can rely on. So for me, always from the beginning, whatever else was happening, alcohol was the thing that was on the table. That had to be, if that was there, I was going to be okay. Alcohol was there, I'm okay. And I just launched into, when I was 16 years old, I got, I dropped out of boarding school, high school. My father came back into my life and said, you've obviously got insane, and had me committed to my first mental institution. I was in a, they put me in for 3 months of observation and a year of rehabilitation, and you taking 3 cups of pills a day and just shuffling around the unit, you know what I mean? And they, when you act out, they start signing you up for shock treatment. When all of a sudden you get very well behaved when they start talking about the shock treatment. And I felt that what I should do is escape. I should escape from the mental institution. So I made my plan, and I'd been having all my meals with this woman named Kilday. Kilday was nuts, but very entertaining. And all you had to do to flip Kilday out was just look at her and say, Kilday, how you doing? Kilday's, wow! And off she would go. So every meal was like dinner and a show. You know what I mean? You have your little meal and you flip Kilday out and she'd spin around the room. So when it was time to escape, I used Kilday as my diversion. So I flipped Kilday out and the exit sign's over there, the door's over there, met my little table. I've been shuffling around in there, taking my 3 cups of pills a day. I hadn't made a fast move in many, many days, right? But I'm going to make one now. I'm all ready, and I get Kilday flipping out that way. It's ready, 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 go! And I'm hauling ass. That's all I got. Just arms are working, the whole thing, right? Just look. What? You hear from the nurse's station over the loudspeaker, Ed, when you got a minute, you want to grab Earl? He's making a break for the door. Yeah. Ed's in there having a sandwich going, don't worry about it, I'll get him, he ain't going nowhere. Three coast cut, you got to get out before they get the Thorazine in you. The Thorazine just, you got slow and stopped. That's it. There is no move to make. So back in the nut house, back to the room with no doorknob. Finally talked my way out of that nut house. The second time I got committed, I did escape. I escaped on the first day. I was in the intake process, and my mother was there and ran her hands, and I was crazy, and they were checking me, and I just said, hey, look at that, and I took off. Thank you. And I'm going through this place, and the whistles are going off, and the bells are going off, and I'm running through, and I hit this door, and I'm out in the backyard, and I'm running across this lawn towards a 12-foot ivy-covered chain-link fence. And I got a little theme song playing in my head, you know. This guy chasing me, right? And at this point in my life, I'm 16, 17 years old. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. I'm a high school dropout. I'm at any moment, hopefully, an escaped mental patient. This is like my resume. This is what I have to say for myself. And I figure if I make that fence, I don't have any problems. Because this is Los Angeles. I make that fence, I'm high in 20 minutes. All right? And that's all that matters to me. Because, see, I'm different. I'm different than the normal man. I drink and use no matter what. Given a good reason, I don't stop. That's the difference between me and the problem drinker. Problem drinker gets a good reason to stop. Problem drinker goes before the judge one more time for a drunk driving charge, and the judge says, you know what, I'm sick of you. I see you one more time, you're going to do a year in county jail. No conversation. You're just going to do a year in county jail, and we'll talk when you get out. Problem drinker hears that and says, I don't want to go to jail for a year. Makes a decision to actually stop drinking and driving and can follow through on that decision. Stops drinking and driving. Me, I start wondering what it's going to be like in jail because I'm going. I know I'm going now. I can't make that. I can make the decision. I can decide, well, that's it. I'm not drinking and driving anymore. But I cannot follow through on that. I'll be drunk and behind the wheel that afternoon. Because it's who I am. I drink and use no matter what. There's a little saying in my neck of the woods where they tell newcomers, just don't drink or use no matter what. Period. That's what they say. And I respectfully disagree with that. If I could do that, if I could just not drink or use no matter what, I would not be a member of AA. There would have been no reason to come to you. I wouldn't have had the experience of coming to Iceland. I wouldn't read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would not work those steps. we can go anywhere near the four step. I would not take a phone call at 3 a.m. in the morning from a terrified newcomer who's decided 3 a.m. is a good time to call me to talk about it. I wouldn't do that because I'd be home just not drinking or using no matter what. I could do that. But I'm the opposite. I drink and use no matter what. All the signs come and I can't do it. I remember a guy, I was 16 and a half years old, and he looked at me and said, "You know, you're an alcoholic." And I looked at him, "What's your point? If that's what you call this, fine. If this is what you call an alcoholic, fine, then I'm an alcoholic. That doesn't change anything for me. Put whatever label you want on this, but this is what I must do. This is how I breathe. This is how I function. This is how I live. You want to call me an alcoholic? Knock yourself out. I'm an alcoholic. But this is how I live." Got out of the nut, escaped that nut house, hit the street, spent 3 years out on the street doing what people like me do to stay drunk on a daily basis. I thought it was me and Jack Kerouac, man, on the road. It's going to be poetic and dramatic and romantic and all that, and it was none of those things. It was hardcore and it was nasty. But you do what you got to do to stay loaded. I went to a party when I was 19, and I met a woman named Rosemary. Rosemary and I talked for 20 minutes, and it went well, so we were in love. And we felt it was appropriate to begin our new life together after that 20 minutes. And I thought, well, you know, there's nothing going on here that looks like the stuff that's going on TV. You know what I mean? Family life, how people live, you know, a house, two cars, you know, a washer and a dryer. I mean, there's just nothing going on here that looks like it's going to lead to anything like that. So maybe we should do something. And I thought, well, I'll go to college. And she says, well, you know, you don't have a high school diploma. Details. And I found that they were doing interviews for a very good business college in Northern California. And so I went over to have an interview with these people. And we know what to do. You know, you're out on the street long enough, you know what to do. Walked in and found out that this guy was a musician. So I was a musician. His favorite color was blue. That's unbelievable. My favorite color? Blue. And I just lined right up with this guy. And an hour and a half later, he said that I would be a fine addition to their campus in the fall. And I got accepted to business college. So I went back to my father and said, look, I got accepted to business college, Northern California. Don't ask. Just if you give me a year's tuition, I'm out of town. My father said, beautiful. Wrote a check. Me and Rosemary piled all our belongings and 8 pounds of hash in the back of this truck and drove to Northern California for higher learning. And she got a straight job, and I was going to college, and I gave them a year's tuition, told them transcripts are in the mail, went down to local high school to get my high school equivalency done. I'm doing this. She gets a straight job. I become a drug dealer. And I have no qualms about becoming a drug dealer. I have no morals. I have no ethics. I have no sense of family, no sense of community. I don't know anything about any of that. All I know is that I'm out there, I'm on my own, it's up to me, and this is what I know about, so this is what I'll do. So I become a drug dealer. I'm studying marketing, production, distribution in business college. I'm applying it to my business. Business is booming. I got a great business. I think this is great, right? I turn 20. I go in to get a physical examination. They determine that I have malignant cancer. Great. So I fly back to L.A., and they do major surgery in my upper back, and they prepare me to die. They prepare my family for me to die. And I remember looking at them and thinking, you guys don't even know who you're talking to, because my using was getting out of control at this point. I was starting to overdose and end up in ambulances and hospitals, getting my stomach pumped, doing that kind of stuff. It was already completely out of control when I was 20. And I came down, they did the surgery, they put me in the nuclear medicine program, they call it in those days, and I'm a long-term cancer survivor. I beat the cancer thing. And I never even think about it, really. It's just not relevant to my life, you know. Either, you know, win the lottery or you don't, you know, and I won. So I just kept moving, you know, and I went back up to school, and the next thing you know, I'm junior in college. I've got an early acceptance to USC Law School. I'm going to go to law school because the way I'm living, I'm figuring I'm going to need an attorney. And my mother calls me and says, we haven't been anywhere as a family in 10 years. We need to get together as a family. We're going to go on a trip for your birthday. We'll go anywhere you want to go. But we have to do this now to put this family back together. I said, fine. So I got in my car, flew back down from up north. And my 22nd birthday, on my birthday, we took off to fly to Guadalajara. And on the way there, the plane crashed. And my mother, my father, my little sister all died in the crash, and I didn't. And I woke up on this mountain in Mexico, and my mother was laying over there, and my little sister Kimberly was laying over there, and my father was over there. And I had fractured my skull, broken my back in three places, crushed the leg and the arm. I was paralyzed from the waist down. I had a lot of internal injuries. And I was awake. And I couldn't, the only thing I could move was my right arm. And I couldn't get to any of them to help them. And so I laid there and I watched them all bleed to death right in front of me. And I had a chat with God. And I said, you know what? Any God that would take a kind, gentle, loving creature like my little sister Kimberly and leave me here, me, I have no use for a God of this type. I renounced God. There's no God that I'm interested in. And then some guys came up and they scavenged the plane wreck and they took whatever they could gather, took their money, took the money out of my wallet, threw it back on my chest and moved to the wreck and took what they could scavenge and back down and left me there to die. So I had no more love for you either. I was out. I was out. I had no love of God. I had no feeling at all except anger towards my fellow man. I was completely and utterly alone in the world at that point by choice. And, finally some guys came up and they found me and they put me in the back of a flatbed pickup truck with my mother and they took us down to an aid station in Mexico and they tagged her dead and they tagged me dead and they sat there smoking cigarettes waiting for me to die because I looked bad, bad. And I didn't die and they finally they took me to a hospital, Hospital Fatima in Los Mochis, Mexico. And, they got my ID, and then they notified the federales, so that brought the federales. And the federales, the Mexican police, interrogated me through an interpreter for 3.5 days and wouldn't give me anything for pain. They wanted to know what I was doing back in Mexico, which is another story we don't need to get into here, but they were not glad to see me. And finally, I just couldn't take it anymore, and I called an associate of mine in Northern California who called a family in Mexico City, and they flew in a plane, and they paid off some folks and plastered me up from my neck to my hips and put me on a plane and smuggled me back out of Mexico. And I ended up in a hospital in California for a long time. And they said, I might have a withered left hand, might probably be blind in my left eye, and I might may or may not walk again. And I remember looking at him and thinking, you have no idea what's happening inside me. I was so crazy and so cold inside and just locked away from the world. And I was on maximum doses of Demerol around the clock in there. And I was in, and when I came out of there crazy, completely crazy. I had pictures in my head I knew I couldn't live with. I knew I couldn't survive this. And I'm going to go out and I'm going to drink and use the way I want to drink and use. And I don't care what any of you think about it. It's just the way I'm going out is to let you know how much I hate this life, the living of it, this world and everything in it. I've never been any good at being a part of you. I've never been any good at this living of life and and making friends. I just don't know how to do any of this. I'm out, and I hate the pain and the madness inside me, and I'm going to go drink and use till I die just to show you, and I'm going to show you along the way how I feel about this thing called living. And I came out of that hospital, and I went on my last run, and it was for 6 years. And you got to understand what I'm saying to you when I say I went on a run for 6 years. I think I'm one of those guys that had no anchors. Do you know what I mean? I'm one of those lost boys that didn't have an anchor. I had no family that on some level inside me I was trying to keep it together for. I didn't have a wife. I didn't have children. I didn't have a career. I didn't have hopes or dreams of any kind. I didn't have anything that to hold me to you. There was nothing holding me to you. I was just this crazed alcoholic, and I used for another 6 years. For 4 years, in that six-year period, I got sober 3 times, and they were for 72 hours each. And I'd get so sick I couldn't drink anymore. So I'd go to this little bootleg sanitarium in Hollywood, California. We'd go in and you'd give them 150 cash, and you'd give them your wallet and your bottle of Valium and your car keys and your gun or whatever else you had going on. And they'd take you in, and they'd strap you to a gurney, and they'd shoot you full of anticonvulsants so that you didn't convulse to death on them, and they just let you rock. And you kicked like a dog on that gurney. And I did that 3 times. The 3rd time I did it, I reintroduced myself to God because I was dying. And I said, you know, it's me, you know. And my attitude was, you know what, man, and you owe me. You know, you get me, I'll make you a deal, pal. You get me through this sane and alive, and both seem to be up for grabs, and I will never, ever, ever drink or use again as long as I live. And I meant that with every fiber of my being. Every fiber of my being. And I got up off of that gurney, I went outside, and I got in my car, and I went and I drank for 2 more years. Because I could not stop drinking. I could not stop. The end for me, when I stopped drinking, I came out of my last blackout, which was just a normal thing for me. And at that moment, and I had what they refer to in Alcoholics Anonymous, a moment of clarity. And that clarity for me was that I was not connected to another human being on the face of the earth. My soul was dying. Of course my body was dying, but my soul was dying. I was so dark and alone. I'd been alone for so long, I didn't even know that I was lonely. I had nothing to compare it to. Nothing to compare it to. Both my hands were broken. At that point in my life, it was the day before my 28th birthday. I weighed 215 pounds. I had hair out like this and a beard like this. I was yellow. My thyroid had stopped functioning. My heart was swollen. I couldn't touch my kidneys or my liver. I was psychotic, and I don't use that term loosely. They were deciding whether or not to charge me with attempted murder. I'd broken 74 bones. I had over 650 stitches in me, and I was completely alone. I just burned my life to the ground. There was nothing to look at to say, you know, well, this is going okay, so we'll just go with this. You know what I mean? It was just flatlined. And I had the moment of clarity. And both my hands were broken. I put them up, and I just said, help me. Help me. And they threw me in an ambulance, and they took me to a UCLA emergency, and they knew me, and they pumped my stomach. I had my stomach pumped so many times they could run the tubes on me, and I could talk to you. It was, you know, how you doing, Earl?
It was a bad day. Bad day.
You know,
sorry to bother you guys.
And they just said, get him out of here, he's dying. And they took me to another place, and they kept me 5 days, and I got worse because the kick was surreal. And then they took me by ambulance to another place, and they kept me for 17 days of detox and then 30 days on a free bed because my life was destroyed. I had nowhere to go. I had nothing. And I left there, and I knew one thing. They said, Earl, if you don't want to die, you better go to Alcoholics Anonymous because that is the only chance you have. And I had been, as the book says, beaten into a state of reasonableness. And I said, okay. And I ended up in the basement of a church. See, they knew it was me. They knew I'd be a blubbering idiot up here. So they've got 4 pounds of... I'm so tired, man. I don't even know what I'm talking about. And I went in. It was a Friday night. It was the basement of a church. 8:30 p.m. Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And I walked into the back of that room, and my alcoholism was in full effect. I had kicked physically, but the greater aspect of my disease, the obsession of the mind, was whirling. And I walked in that room like the criminal I was, man. I sat in the back row, hair out like this, arms folded, best tough guy look on my face, mad dogging everybody that looked at me. What do you want? You don't want to come over here. You don't want to come over here. Because I was terrified. None of my tools for living were drugs, alcohol, violence, and run. I didn't have any of those left. They'd all been beaten out of me by alcoholism. I had no tools for living. I was like glass when I came to AA. I was so afraid you would walk up to me. This is the truth. I was so terrified that you would walk up to me and ask me a question I couldn't answer. Like, how you doing? I don't know. What's going on? Don't know. Yeah. How are you? Don't know. Never been in this place before. Never been here before. Don't understand where I am. I feel like I'm on acid now. I'm stone cold sober for the first time since I was 12 years old. Dude, I can feel the planet revolving under my feet. I'm a raw nerve. And I'm sitting in the back of a meeting. And the old timers saw me. They knew who I was. And they didn't come up on me. They just said, glad you're here, brother. Get yourself a cup of coffee. Have a seat.
Yeah.
sitting in the back of an AA meeting. And I'm looking where all the doors and the windows are, and I'm listening, I'm scanning the room, and I'm listening to you guys talk, and I'm trying to find out who's got the juice, who's got the power, who's got the A&A deal in here, who is it? And I'm going to find out who that is. I'm going to slide up on him. I'm going to burglarize his conversations. I'm going to find out what you got, and then I'm gone. I'm going to take what you have, and I'm leaving, because I don't join stuff. You know, and this all looks like nice and happy, but you look like normal people. And normal people, if I tell you the way that I've lived and the things that I have done, you will ask me to leave. Because that's what normal people would do, and you look like normal people. And I sat in the back filled with fear, and this guy got up and he spoke. He was an ex-boxer, he was a Skid Row bum, and he was a wino. I was none of those things. And I noticed the differences between you and me, you know, when I got here. If you're a woman, you don't know about me. Not because we're better or worse, just because you're a woman. You come up in something else. Your struggles are different than mine. If you're 5 years older or 5 years younger, you don't know about me. You come up in another time, in another generation, in another scene, right? If you're gay, if you're Hispanic, you're Asian, you're whatever, you mean, you don't know about me. You come up in something else, right? So, I mean, I had the wagon circle so tight by the time I got here. If you're not Earl, you don't know about me. You're something else. You're doing something else. I'm isolated. I'm alone. I don't have to listen to you if I can tell the differences between you and I. And I sat in the back of the room, and that guy's a Skid Row bum, a wino, and an ex-boxer. He's got nothing for me. And then he kept talking. And suddenly it was like, this guy was talking openly and honestly about his feelings as a man. He was showing emotion from the podium. And he was doing it with a dignity and a grace that was unavoidable. And I'd never seen anybody do that before. It was completely foreign to me. And then he was like, he looked right at me and he said, you know what, I don't care whether you like what I got to say or not. You don't like it? Go to another meeting. And I loved that. I loved it because it made it clear to me he wasn't selling me something. He was sharing it with me. If I wanted it, I could have it. It was for free. If I didn't want it, cool. Go to another meeting. Maybe you'll hear somebody you can identify with there. And something happened inside me. It was like that man with his story and how he identified and how he shared his experience, his strength, and the hope that was there for me. He reached out and he touched me here. I was defenseless. I was defenseless. There was nothing I could do about it. And I remember thinking, this is pretty cool. I think I'm going to have to come back here. I think I'm going to have to come back. And I've never left. Today I've got 22 years, 10 months, and 7 days of sobriety. And I couldn't stay sober for a day. Couldn't stay sober for a day. And there is only one reason why I can say that I have been sober for 22 years, 10 months, and 7 days. And that is because I am an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Period. That's it. And I don't mean an active member of the fellowship. I am that. What I mean is an active member of all of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am an active participant in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I am an active member of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they serve two fundamentally different purposes for me. I'm one of the lucky ones. I went to that meeting, and these guys came up, and they said, we got another meeting. There's over here. You could come to that. I went, yeah. And I waited, and I went to the same meeting I went to the Friday before. I waited a week, and I went back to the same Friday night meeting. And I sat in the back. Didn't talk to anybody. And a woman got up to speak. And I went, where's the guy? And the guy next to me says, what guy? I said, the guy that talks here. I heard him last week. I came back to hear some more from that guy. I didn't know anything about it, right? And the guy looks at me and goes, you're new, aren't you? I said, yeah, what's your point, pal? He says, we have male speaker, female speaker. We got other meetings, too. We got men's stags and women's stags and participation meetings and a candlelight meeting. And I'm like, whoa. Right? I wrap my head around get car, go meeting here, guy, go home. That was all I could handle. And then he's just like fanning out all over the place with all this stuff that they do. And I'm thinking, take it easy. And then the woman gets up to speak. This woman's like 65 years old. It's like everybody's grandma's getting up. Now, I got nothing in common with this lady, right? I'm thinking, what, she, you know, having a little glass of sherry by the pool, broke the glass and came running into AA? This ought to be entertaining. So Granny gets up and starts to explain Any reasonably attractive female alcoholic should be able to drink for 2 weeks on 50 cents and then breaks down precisely how you go about doing that, right? And I'm listening to Granny and I'm thinking, I'd drink with her. Granny's intense, man. Granny's intense. And then it hits me. My God, I'm identifying with Grandma. What's going on here? And then you go back the next week and there's another guy. He's got a different story. This guy's got a different story. But there was this common undeniable thread. Common problem, alcoholism. Common solution, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Common problem, alcoholism. Common solution, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it started to sink in. And then they said, you got to get a sponsor. I said, fine. What's a sponsor? They said, somebody who's got what you want. And I said, well, I would like to drink. I would like to drink. So maybe it's a little early to be tossing it back my way. And I have since come to believe that what I want is a sponsor who's got what he wants. It's a good definition of happiness, wanting what you have. Right? So I looked around and I found this madman. The late, great Donald Madden became my sponsor. And I asked Donald Madden to sponsor me and he said, yeah, I'll sponsor you. You don't have to like what I tell you. You don't have to think it's a good idea. You just have to do it. Okay. And he started calling me up and saying, we're going to meet at Ohio Street at 7:30. The meeting starts at 8:30. We get there early for the new people and to help them set up the meeting. We'll see you there. Click. And I'm thinking, I didn't hear an invitation. I did not hear, Earl, would you like to go to a meeting? I didn't hear that. Earl, how do you feel about going to a meeting? Thank God I didn't hear that. What I heard was, we're meeting at the meeting, we'll see you there. Click. Oddly enough, Donald was not interested in as Earl sees it. He was not interested in that. He didn't want to hear from me. Whenever I would listen to him say, you know, Donald, what I think, he'd go, no talking. No talking. You see, we don't want what you have, Earl. And I was standing there with this defiant look on my face thinking, you know, if I had any place else left to go, I would go there now. Luckily for me, there is no other place I have left to go. This is it. Great way to get here, destroyed. So I funneled Donald Madden around, and Donald Madden was Alcoholics Anonymous to me. He didn't tell me about Alcoholics Anonymous. He showed me. When I would show up at a meeting early, Donald would already be there with another newcomer sitting up the chairs. Right? When I would call Donald, he'd say, I have to call you back. I'm talking to another guy. He was always being a service. He was so active. And we had a Sunday night men's meeting where we would go and we would sit and talk about the steps and read through the 12 and 12. And I would listen to these guys that he sponsored, this insane band of men. And I just was in awe of who they were and how comfortable they were being who they were. It was just remarkable to me, and I just kept coming. And they were so kind to me. They loved me when I needed to be loved. They kicked me in the ass when I needed to be kicked in the ass. And you know what was great about a guy like Donald Madden? Donald Madden much preferred that I was angry at him and alive than happy with him and dead. So he would, in this remarkable way, get in my face and say, no, that is not what we do here. This is what we do here. So get your ass out of that chair and come sit over here. We don't sit in the back of meetings. We sit in the front. And we don't get to meetings 5 minutes before the meeting. We get to meetings 30 minutes before the meetings. I said, well, why? He said, because you know what? There's a lot of guys out there like you, Earl, that have no place else to go. And they come to the meetings early to try to find some recovery. So we're there for them early so that we can talk to them. We can get them a big book. We can show them the ropes. We can let them know what's about to happen. So maybe they can get just that little bit more out of that meeting. And we get their phone numbers and we hook these guys up. That's why we come early. And we stay late because we help put the chairs away. And I just said, okay. And I did that stuff because I didn't know there was any other way to do it. Because that's how Donald Madden did it. And Donald Madden had the light in his eyes, man. Donald Madden had the passion for life. Donald Madden was in the game. Alcoholics Anonymous had done the thing for him that I thought was impossible. A hopeless alcoholic was back in the game of life. And he was passionate about that. And I said, that's what I want. I want to feel strongly about something. He said, you want what I got? Do what I did to get it. Don't follow me around. Listen to me. Do what I did. Come. action, action, action. So we did that, and it was just Mary Band, and we had meetings and panels, and I'm going to 7 to 9 meetings a week, and I'm taking out panels, and I'm never turning down an AA request. I am AA boy, boy. I am in it. And I start getting a little squirrely. And I go up to this old-timer in a meeting, and I said, you know, I'm going to 7 to 9 meetings a week. I'm calling my sponsor every day. I'm doing this, blah, 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 blah. And the guy looks at me and goes, kid, that's how you get sober. If you don't get a program, you're going to die. Get away from me. I said, hold on there, Pop. I'm doing all this stuff. And he said, Earl, that's the fellowship. Vital to your recovery. Glad you're involved. But the program is found in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I suggest you read it like your life depends upon it, because frankly, we saw you come in, and it does. Get away from me. I said, all right, you old bastard. I'll get a big book. And me and this friend of mine, Christopher, got together. And we got the big book. And we started following around the guys we avoided at all costs. You know, the big book thumpers. The guys who were talking about the book. You know, the zealots. We thought those are the zealots. You know, I'm going to beware the zealots, right? And so we're following these guys around. And we're reading this book. We're getting these tapes. And we're reading along. And I'm telling you, man, every few minutes, we would be sitting there. And one of us would go, hey, you know that thing they say? There it is, right there. Right there in the book. And I go, I know, man. I wondered where they got that. Yeah, they got it right here. It's in the book. And then we read a little bit further and go, there's another one. Another one right there. This thing is amazing. And we're reading through this thing and we're working through the steps. And I'm feeling kind of spooky because I'm watching Christopher. He's changing. He's turning into somebody else going through this step thing. And I'm watching him. I think, I ain't saying nothing. We'll just keep doing this thing, right? And all of a sudden, one day he says, Earl, I got to tell you, man, you're freaking me out. What am I doing? He goes, you're really changing. I said, dude, you. So I was thinking the same thing. It's like freaking me out. What do you do? We were taking these actions, and it was having an impact on us. The change was happening. We were becoming something other than we were. We were, for the first time, addressing the obsession of the mind. We were finding out that it's not enough for a guy like me. I cannot stop drinking and using, kick, come in here, go to meetings, and make it. That's not my story. I'm not that kind of guy. I'm a hopeless alcoholic. That's who I am. I came here hopeless. I can't do that. I have to do the whole deal. I have to get into the whole game. And what the book showed me was there's this circle with a triangle in it, right? It's an ancient spiritual symbol that stands for mind, body, and spirit brought together as a whole human being. And therein lies the balance I've sought my whole life, and I've never had drunk or sober. Alcoholics Anonymous adopted that symbol. It's the same thing, unity, service, and recovery. Unity's the body. I must bring it here. I couldn't get sober, but we seem to be able to. I must involve myself in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I must be with you, my kind. We look each other in the eye, and we know, and we understand. I can try to explain it to the normie out there till dawn. He's not going to even come close to understanding what I'm talking about, because he hasn't been to the beast, man. He has not danced with the beast, and I have. And you have. So when I tell you that the beast is on me, you know what I mean. And you know what to do. You know what to do. Turning myself into them is meaningless. Turning myself into you is everything. So I must engage in that first side of the triangle. The unity is the body. I must bring it here. The recovery is of the mind, the greater aspect of this disease. I have to find a way to be comfortable sober. And the only way I can be comfortable sober is I'm relieved of the obsessive nature of my mind. The persistence of this illusion, this belief in a lie that I can drink like a normal man is astonishing. And I will dance and I will hear the beast whisper to me. I'll be in a meeting sweeping up Ohio Street. I'm the cleanup guy. I'm 2.5 years sober. I'm sweeping up and the beast will whisper to me. How you doing, Earl? It's been a long time, man. I thought I'd swing by and say hello. How's that? What's up? Huh? Listen, man, I've been watching, you know what I mean? And people have been treating you very, very unfairly. It's just, you know, it's rude. And I can see that it's, you know, it's hurtful, Earl. It's hurtful. And I can see that you're very hurt by it. And you're very, frankly, very stressed out by it. And we know stress is very, very, very unhealthy, Earl. I can see you're wound up tight as a man. This is unhealthy. And I mean, I think for medicinal purposes, I have a plan. Here's the plan. Let's just go get a couple of drinks. Take it easy. Take it easy. Don't overreact. Don't overreact. This time it will be different. Trust me. I'm here for you, Earl. I love you. Everything's going to be okay. Your sponsor's looking at you. Smile and wave. Smile and wave. Very good. Very good. Here's where I'm going to go. I'm going to have a couple of drinks, and I'm going to be here for you. I love you. I've always been here for you, Earl, haven't I? I've always been here for you, brother. And we're going to unwind this spring in you, and we're going to work this out, and then we're just going to slide right back into this A&A thing you seem so interested in. You know, and you know what? We don't. Let's just keep this between you and me. Let's just keep this our little secret. Now I'm sweeping up. I got a commitment in AA, and I'm sitting there thinking, yeah, sounds reasonable. Persistence of this illusion, this belief in a lie, is astonishing. I have that drink, I activate the physical phenomenon of craving, and that beast talking to me in a whole other tone. It's going, glad we're back, Earl. Listen, let's get to the car quickly. We got to head downtown. We got a lot of things we're going to have to get done before dawn. Are you ready? Here we go. And he's in charge. It's like, okay, here we go. Because I don't have two drinks. I've never had two drinks. There's no point in having two drinks. I can't kill the fear with two drinks. The only reason to have two drinks is to have two drinks while you're waiting for him to bring you another couple of drinks. That's it. It's pointless, two drinks. I shouldn't even comment on normal drinking. I've never done it. I've seen it done. I find it bizarre. So I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous in the session of the mind's in full effect. Unity is the body. I bring it here. I must be with you. Recoveries of the mind. I must be relieved of this obsession. I can't dance with the beast like this, because someday the planets are going to line up and life on life's terms is going to happen and the shit is going to hit the fan. And I'm going to find out I ain't in charge of the fan. It's going to happen. And if he's there and he's whispering, I'm going to blink and I'm going to be dead. Or worse. We all know there's worse than dead. And I don't want to go there. I don't want to be there. So I got to address that voice in my head, that obsession. How do you do it? Work the steps. It's their four. That's the whole point of the steps. Step one, what's the problem? Lack of power. What's the solution to lack of power? A power greater than myself. Step two. Make a decision. Step three, to do something about it. What should I do? 4 through 9. 4 and 5, me. 6 and 7, God. 8 and 9, you. Nobody else to play with. 10, 11, and 12, me, God, and you. Notice the order in that. Get it cleared up here. Hook it up with God. Take it out in the world. Hook it back up out there. Right? 10, 11, and 12, keep me in the game. Keep me in the game, because I just scratched the surface. I got to get into this. I'm looking for the magic, man. I'm not looking for a Band-Aid to put on the bullet hole of my soul. I am looking for the magic. I need the big buzz. I've always been about the buzz. I was about the buzz when I was getting loaded. I'm about the buzz now. I need to experience life. I want it. Alcoholics Anonymous, you know what it gives me back? Right now. In there. There's no other place to be. No other life. Right here, right now. There's nothing. Dinner's over, folks. Right? And it ain't time to go to bed. Can't live there, can't live there. Gotta be here now. This is all there is. Right here, right now, I got enough. Right here, right now, with you, I'm okay. Can I bring all of who I am into this moment? Not in the beginning, not in the old days. That's what drinking and using was about. I got to get out of right here, right now, because I'm self-centered and afraid. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me back right now. It was the only place I can live my life. The only place I can love you. The only place I can know what honor or dignity is a man. It's now. It's now. In between those. That's what my second sponsor, after the late, great Donald Madden passed away. I did not have a sponsor for 3 hours, because I heard Donald Madden in my head say, "You cannot walk around unattended. You're not ready." So I called up Al and I said, "Al, Donald's dead. Will you sponsor me?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "What do you want me to do?" He said, "Prayer and meditation is all that's left for you, man. You got everything else smoking. You got to get in here, Earl. You got to get in there. You got to get in there." And I said, "Okay." The prayer and the meditation began. And that's how it started for me, that aspect of my recovery. The power of the 11th step. Just phenomenal. That's the fourth dimension lives, man. The presence of that in your life. To be able to breathe in and breathe out and be different as the situation requires. To try to have the opportunity, whether it's exercised or not, to bring balance, clarity, focus, and peace to whatever situation is in front of me. That's a remarkable, remarkable thing. This is a way past not drinking and using, man. This is called a design for living. This is how I get to live life. Become a passionate man once again, as opposed to a dead, soulless, useless human being that had done nothing but harm other people for years. And become something entirely different. To have the pendulum swing completely. To go from a useless shell of a human being to leading an exceptional life. How? Alcoholics Anonymous. How? Walk a spiritual path. How? Chop the wood and carry the water of AA. do the deal. It can get lofty and it can get grand, but it's the simplest of things. It's the simplest of things. Clean. Unity's the body, I bring it here. Recovery's of the mind, I work the steps. As a result of working those steps, I'm relieved of the obsession of the mind. The beast is no longer upon me. He sleeps quietly now. And based on my daily reprieve, I can practice these principles in all my affairs. The third side of the triangle, the spiritual. That's not to suggest that it all isn't. But the spiritual, that I can be of service. How can I help you? It's now I can be with you. How can I help you? Not because I'm a good guy, because I don't want to die in a gutter. And that's where guys like me die, is in the gutter. We die hopeless and alone. That's what we do. We don't come have fine meals with people from a beautiful country. It's not, you know, and share our experience, strength, and hope together. Guys like me don't get to do this. Guys like me die. And I didn't. I didn't die. And I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. When I was 5 years sober, I went to my first AA conference. And I walked into the back because I was too afraid to do anything else. I'd been to a meeting a day for 5 years, had commitments to the whole thing. And I walked into the back of a conference, and there was a guy named Franklin W. from Olive Branch, Mississippi, talking. He was one of the original circuit speakers. It was an old gentleman up there, and I sat down, and I felt like he looked right across the room, and he said, I'll sum up Alcoholics Anonymous for you in six words, those six words being, trust God, clean house, help others, me, God, and you. And it blew the top of my head off, and I had a spiritual experience, and all these little pieces of AA, all these little slogans, all these little things that we do, all just went, shoo! And it was whole for me. And I thought, that's what I need to do, that's what I need to do. Last year, I was 21 years sober, and I went to Texas to speak at the Texas State Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I saw a man there that I'd known for some time. His name is Searcy. Searcy's like 57 years sober. He's 91 years old. He's been married to the same woman for 68 years. I mean, the guy is sharp as a tack. And he talks, and he said, Earl, come over here. I want to tell you a story. And I said, okay. I'm going to go sit at the right hand of Searcy, man, and, you know, hear about the beginning days of AA. It's like goosebumps, you know what I mean? It's like, wow. You know, and I'm sitting there, and he says, you know, I was in a conversation with Franklin W. and Bill Wilson, and the hair stands up on the back of my neck. And we were asking Bill, what is it about this A&A thing? What is it? What is it we will bring to the generations that are yet to come as the world continues to change? What is the heart and soul of this thing that we will bring to the generations that have yet to come? And Bill said, well, that's easy. Trust God, clean house, and help others. And then 16 years later, that thing came full circle. And I was talking to a guy who was talking to Franklin W., who was talking to Bill Wilson, and that was the heart of this. Me, God, and you. Me, God, and you. That's the deal. That's what I must embrace. And as I embrace this, as I find this, I have to understand the duality of so much of this spiritual information. I have to understand that to keep it, I must give it away. And that's not just a cute little slogan in AA, that's the real deal. If I want the big buzz, if I want to catch the real buzz, if I want light fire in my life, if I want to lead a passionate, powerful life, if I want this moment as much as I want anything else, because nothing else can happen outside of it, if I want this moment, I must turn and do as Donald Madden asked of me, who said, I will give you everything I have. And all I will ask is that you honor this by when you catch the buzz, Earl, you give it away to the next man coming in through that door. You give it away to the next. You become a part of this human chain of this spiritual life. And so I have sponsored men. Always, always I have sponsored men. Far too many men. Many would tell me. But I think how many men you sponsor is a good example of how destroyed you were when you got here. I sponsor a lot of them. And I carry the message to them, and they carry to the guys that they sponsor. And I thought Donald Madden was dead, and I grieved the loss of Donald Madden. Until I gave a guy that I sponsor who took an 11-year cake about 5 years ago. And he said, I want to thank Earl H. for carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And then he said, and I want to thank the late, great Donald Madden for carrying it to him. And I just started to cry because I knew Donald Madden's not dead. Donald Madden's going to live forever. In me. In Carl. In Karen. In Doug. In you. Thank you. and he should. But I've got to remember, as I get embrace all of this and I sponsor these young men, I sponsor Satan. I do. His name is Louis. Louis has a shaved head with two horns of red hair shellacked up on his head. He lives like this all day, every day. Red horns shellacked up onto his head. He has a thin beard that spirals down off of his face like this. He has a red tail of the devil tattooed up his back. He has flames tattooed up his legs as if he's standing in the fires of hell. One day I gave a talk and Louis ran up to me and said, "Dude, you have to be my sponsor." And my first thought is, what the hell am I throwing out there that Satan's coming up and identifying him? Louis's 11 years sober and is a tremendous example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the midnight madness meetings in Hollywood, California, when those little speed freak kids that are 16 and 17 years old come screaming in off the boulevard trying to find an AA meeting because they're 16, 17 years old and they're coming in just in time. They are burned to a crisp. And they come screaming into those meetings and they look around, they go, "Holy shit, the devil got sober." There's Louis standing there, and Louis walks over to him and says, "It's all right, little bro, you don't have to drink or use one day at a time anymore if you don't want to, and I can show you how." Louis the magic man, man. He can get the people none of us can touch. Louis walks in and says, "Sit down, I'd like to talk to you," and they just go, "Okay." And he's the kindest, gentlest, sweetest guy you'd ever want to meet. And I got to remember, I hear Al Sines is talking. Al Sines is talking. Are you kidding me? This guy's a spiritual giant. He was my second sponsor before Luther Wood, the magnificent one, who is my sponsor now, who's like the samurai, man. He's amazing. You want to know what love and tolerance looks like? Come to my hometown and just follow Luther W. around. Follow Luther around and you will see what love and tolerance looks like. That's who he is. He's just a magnificent human being. He's so strong. He's so powerful. He need not be anything but kind. He's what I want to be. He's what I want to be. But I hear that Al's talking spiritual giant. I'm getting Louis. Louis at the time got 9 months. Louis, we're going to go hear Al. And we go and we go to the meeting. And Louis's brand new. And we sit down. And we sit. And here comes Al. And Al is throwing it out there, man. It is just remarkable what Al is talking about. And I'm looking at Louis and I'm thinking, isn't it wonderful that Al, these spiritual gems are being floated down upon us by Al S., right? And Louis is being exposed to this at 9 months. I was 16 years sober before I was able to grasp these things. And here it is, and it's happening to Louis, and it's wonderful. That's not what's happening. Louis and I are having a fundamentally different meeting. Me with my 18 years at the time, or whatever. Louis with his, 14 years of sobriety. Louis with his few months. It's just not happening. Right? He's having a very different meeting. I have to, as a sponsor, remember what it's like to be new. I have to remember me new. Me going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Me going to Friday Night Ohio Street. Big meeting. And driving up to the meeting and think, there's a meeting. I found the meeting hall. It's good. Park the car. Go in. They put the keys on the seat. Put your key on the seat. That'll be your seat. Put your key on the seat. That'll be your seat. Sit down. How am I going to find my seat? Sit next to the guy with the red coat. That'll be your chair. That'll be your seat. Everything will be good. Everything's fine. Put your keys on the meeting and in the meeting and people are walking up going, How you doing? Fine. Meeting starting. Sit down. Good. What do you got? Huh? Guy gets up. You read something. I missed that completely. I don't even know what that happened. What the hell was that? He's reading something. He rarely saw something. I don't know what it was he rarely saw, but he really. Wait. There's 12 things. 12 things. Rarely saw something. 12 things. Rarely was something. 12 things, ABC. 12 things, ABC. There's 12 things in ABC. He's down. I didn't get a lot of that, but I was at 12 things, ABC. Very, very good. Here's another guy. He drank. I drank. This is good. I love this guy. Who is this guy? This is wonderful. Who is this guy? He's down. Find that man. I love that man. Find that man. We're down. We're sitting. Okay, I'll sit. Hey. Just sit. I'm sitting. I'm good. It's good. They're passing a basket. Why are they passing a basket? Don't take the money. Give the money. Money's gone. Good. Good. Where are we going? We're going outside. Smoke. I smoke. We'll smoke. Come on. We'll smoke. Come on. How you doing? Fine. How you doing? Fine. How you doing? They're ringing a bell. We're in. We're going in. Where's the guy with the red coat? Red coat. Where's the guy with the red coat? Sing down to me. Good. This guy. They're reading 12 things. Those aren't the same 12 things as the other 12 things. 24 things in ABC. 24 things ABC. 24 things ABC. He's down. Didn't get a lot. Okay. I gotta remember. Jesus Christ. These people just move right along in here. The guy, he's up. I drank like that. I love this guy. The hell with that guy. I love this guy. I felt like that. How does that guy know how I feel? That is how I feel. This is amazing. I love you. I love you. He's down. I go, like, he's up, we're up. They've got me. We're praying. All right, I know this prayer. It's good. And I would leave the meeting, and I would get in my car, and I would cry all the way home. And I would pace in my little apartment, smoking, get my 1 hour of sleep, and get up and try desperately just to do it again. That was a successful meeting for me in AA. I didn't kill myself or several other people. I didn't drink. They didn't throw a net over me because the insanity was in here. It's a testimony to the human skull, how much pressure it can take. I mean, we should be sitting around in here, and about every few minutes, some newcomer's head should just explode. And they got a special cleanup crew to clean it all up. Newcomers up in the front are going, what the hell's going on? Their sponsor's going, meeting's up front, turn around, don't pay any attention to that. Newcomer's just hanging on. And I got to remember, when I take Louie to the meeting, and I'm having my moment with Al that's taken me years to develop an understanding and a level of experience that allows me to be open enough, cracked open enough by Alcoholics Anonymous to feel what Al is bringing me. And I look down at Louie at the end of the meeting and I say, Louie, what'd you think of the meeting? And Louie looks up at me and says, it was great. We're okay. Louie stayed the whole meeting. Just kept looking at me and looking at Al. Looking at me and looking at Al. You know, and he was okay because he trusted us. You know why he trusted us? Because we're him. Just at a different point on the path, but we're him. So if you're new, we're you. That's who we are. We don't look like you. Thanks to a loving God, we don't feel like you. But we are you. And we are so honored that you would come here and take your turn. And allow us to love you until you can love yourself. That you would come here and be with us. All we want is to share what we have with you. I was talking to a guy upstairs, somewhere between soup and steak. And he said, I don't feel like I'm ready to sponsor people. And I said, have you worked all 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? And he said, yes. And I said, then you're ready. You must share. And he says, well, I don't really know that I have a lot of knowledge. I said, share what you have. Have you experienced a change in your life as a result of working the steps? Yes. Then share what you have. That's all. It's all. You will become startled at how much you know. How much you know that you don't know you know. That's living inside you. That's spinning around inside you, waiting for some newcomer to ask the question that you can then go and respond to. Not as Earl sees it, not as Doug sees it, as Alcoholics Anonymous sees it, as the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous sees it, to open the book and turn to the page and say, here, this is the question, here's the answer, it's for you. This is an amazing thing. I live in a house. I have a house. We bought, my wife and I moved into a house. I have a wife. You know, and people ask me, how's the relationship going, Earl? And I say, as long as her denial holds, we're fine. I'll shut up with this. It's the bewitching hour. We're into another whole day now. Talk for 2 days. Yesterday and today. And I went in the house, and this is the first home I've had since I was 12 years old. This is my home. I have a home. Not some place that I'm hanging my hat until it's time to move on. I have a home. And it has a front lawn. And there are plants living there. Right? And I have neighbors. And my neighbors look over the fence and say, hi, you're new to the neighborhood, welcome. And I just say hello. And we chat and I walk away and I think, they still have no idea. They have no idea who's living here. And it is my responsibility to the family, the sense of family I have now and the sense of community I have now, to make sure they never find that out. To live like an honorable man. And I look up and down the street and everybody's got beautiful green lawns and stuff, and I figure you gotta water this stuff or it dies, and then everybody knows that's where the dope fiends live, right? And so there's a hose, and I've seen people do it, and I get the hose and I turn on the hose and I'm throwing the water around. You know? And then looking around, and there's sycamore trees on my street. They form an archway on my street. And the sun is coming through in the late afternoon through the sycamore trees. It's hitting the water on the plants. And it's getting that little glistening thing going on, you know. And I'm catching a little buzz here. This is nice, right? I'm wondering, all of a sudden it hits me. You know, if I'm not mistaken, these plants are alive. And again, if I'm not mistaken, they breathe in carbon dioxide and they breathe out oxygen. I, on the other hand, am standing right here, breathing in the oxygen and out the carbon dioxide. We got a little thing going on here. Here's a little more for you, my brother. Here's a little more for you, my sister. I'm catching a buzz out here. Guy drives by in car, sees man on lawn watering plants. Now what's happening? Worlds within worlds here. What's happening is alcoholic drug addict on front lawn watering his friends, catching a buzz. That's what's going on. I run in the house to Lori and I say, honey, the plants, they're alive. She says, I know, honey, you got some more friends out in the backyard. Why don't you go play with them? Great! Now, what I'm saying is, here's the big buzz. I get to now, rather than try to figure out how I'm going to survive tonight, I get to marvel in the ordinary. I don't need to hear a bullet go by to feel like I've had an interesting experience, because I'm so dead inside, it takes something like that for me to feel like I'm alive. Now I can water the plants. I can talk to a friend. I can play with my dog. Right? I can hope. I can dream. I can execute dreams. I can make them become real. I can become a part of the human race. I can go to Iceland and meet a remarkable people who have embraced Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm humbled before you by what you do. And I'm reminded one more time in my life what must be. What must be. What I do when I go home is I go to my home group. I talk to my sponsor. I sit quietly in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when they're done, I put the chairs away. And when I am called upon by AA, I go. If I can do that, I remain a free man. I have access to peace, the balance. I can trust God. I can clean house. And I can help others. And what greater life could there be? I love you very much. Thanks.